Thank you all for coming, and thanks also to the college for scheduling so few events during this time slot that you didn't have much choice. This discussion is called Words to Live By. It's in two parts. First, the four of us will talk about passages from various sources that have guided us through our lives. Then we'll open the discussion to all of you. You can comment on what we've said or talk about words that have influenced your own lives. We four panelists are all members of the class of 1966. We've been out of college 50 years. That's the lifespan of the social dorms.
That's right, they're building for us.
We were here when they opened, and we're here now that they're being demolished. 50 years is time, we hope, to acquire some wisdom, or for the purpose of this panel, to borrow some wisdom. We've borrowed wisdom from various sources and applied it to our own lives. The panelists are, in this order, Sam Bartos, who majored in music, Fred Mayo, who majored in history, Phil Steele, who majored in American Studies, and I'm John Kroll, I also majored in American Studies. I mentioned the majors so that you can gauge whether there's any connection between them and the quotes that we choose. Let's begin with Sam.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to be here. These lines have never lost their power over me. Not exactly a rule for living to be obeyed like flossing every day, more in the sense of a phrase we used to hear, the life of the mind. Or another one, proof of the existence of God, moments when a glimpse of something of the hidden nature of God or of the reality of the universe, like the Higgs boson, appears. Recently, the New York Times went to South India to talk to the family of Sri Srinivasan, who was still being considered for the Supreme Court. And a cousin of his, a retired physics teacher, said to the reporter about the kind of Sanskrit chant I do every morning. The practice of chanting enhances memory and cognition. It's also supposed to bring good fortune. I have been doing it every morning for the last 20 years, except for one morning when I took it into my head simply to skip it. I said to Carol, my wife, "Do you think it will matter?" She said, "Oh, it's okay, don't worry." So I skipped it and got on the subway. A half hour later, we had been rerouted. I emerged onto the sidewalk at Fulton Street and looking up saw the orange flames and gray smoke pouring out of the upper floors of the World Trade Center, the debris glinting in that famous sunshine as it fluttered slowly to the pavement. I walked into our 30th floor offices only to see out the windows as the deep blue of New York Harbor and that morning's golden sunshine changed to ochre smoke when the second building collapsed. The date was 9/11/2001, the only morning in the last 20 years when I didn't bother to chant. Just a coincidence. Then there was the All Schubert recital in the fall of 1990. This is a greatly short, and I wrote a half hour speech, and John said 5 minutes, so I have other coincidences, but you get the idea, and really no conclusions, so anyway, onward. Then there was the All Schubert recital in the fall of 1997. I was engaged to play walking distance from the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. The presenter offered his uncle's luxurious condo in the town of Versailles for us to stay in. It was a very serious program, so I wanted a lighter encore and concocted one out of a dozen waltzes with no stops and an accelerated, dizzying ending, like the big party scene in La Traviata where Violetta, the famous fallen woman, the Damo Camilla, sings a waltz about being forever free, sempre libere, to the admiring crowd. I planned to give a little talk about how shocking the waltz was in early 19th century Europe because both of its speed, just like the new railroads, unprecedented, and the physical contact between the partners, a wicked, perhaps evil new thrill, and how Violetta was living a fast life in Paris late at night and loving it. That August 31st, Princess Diana and her lover crashed in a tunnel in Paris very late at night going very fast. The train from Versailles stopped right at the Pont de l'Alma, where the crash occurred, the train from Versailles, and we had to cross it to get to the hall and back every day, right past the immense shrine of flowers, candles, and notes to Diana, who had herself gone so fast in Paris very late one night. I played the encore, but it did not give the little talk. Then the morning when we were studying Chapter 11 bankruptcy in NYU Paralegal School at 11 West 42nd Street facing the library, and I looked out the window and saw the library clock said 11 a.m. It was November 11th, so 11 on 11-11. The Hindus have a name for all this, I think. I could be wrong. Matrika Shakti, numbers, words, puns. I call them karmic puns. The hidden and mysterious eidetic and linguistic structure of everything, and I believe it is what Dylan was thinking of, or might be. And little aside, I remember I was happened to have the luck to talk to John Updike at an event at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and I had just read a story of his, and I said, did this character in that story mean this when he said that? And John Updike looks at me and says, maybe. I don't know. You might be right. Later that same day, this is the 11th, remember, November 11th and Chapter 11. Later that same day, I visited a close lifelong gallerist friend at his opulent digs at number 11 on a fine Upper East Side street just off Fifth Avenue, and thought, looking around at the beautiful surroundings, I thought to myself, what does this have to do with bankruptcy? 3 years later, he was in perhaps the most widely covered art gallery bankruptcy in memory, which he managed to survive, thank God. And finally, 11 West 42nd Street itself was part of the land at issue in the Cardozo case in 1928, owned by the Gerry family, the most famous member of which gave his name to a political trick, the gerrymander, that bedevils our politics to this day in a fundamental way, a trick you could describe as a betrayal on the part of state legislatures of their fiduciary duty. The case is called Meinhard v. Salmon, and every lawyer knows it because of Cardozo's immortal words about the nature of the fiduciary relationship, which really requires no explanation from me. Whether the two gentlemen in the caption were actually partners and owed each other that high level of truthful and trustworthy behavior was the crux of the case, because one of them, the defendant, when the lease was almost up, made a new deal with the Gerry family behind the other guy's back. The lower court was fine with it, but Cardozo reversed and dictated a new contract between them. Cardozo wrote the following, and I read this to you today as much for its timeless beauty as for its meaning, which could almost as easily be applied to classmates as to business partners. Joint adventurers like Cove, this is the whole passage, but a paragraph of which the quote is a centerpiece, and the only part that's really quoted very often, but you're going to hear a little more today for once, just a little more. Joint adventurers like co-partners, this is Cardozo, joint adventurers like co-partners owe to one another, while the enterprise continues, the duty of the finest loyalty. Many forms of conduct permissible in a workaday world for those acting at arm's length are forbidden to those bound by fiduciary ties. A trustee is held to something stricter than the morals of the marketplace. Not honesty alone, but the punctilio of an honor the most sensitive is then the standard of behavior. As to this, there has developed a tradition that is unbending and inveterate. Uncompromising rigidity has been the attitude of courts of equity when petitioned to undermine the rule of undivided loyalty by the disintegrating erosion of particular exceptions. Only thus has the level of conduct for fiduciaries been kept at a level higher than that trodden by the crowd. It will not consciously be lowered by any judgment of this court. I attended law school recently, and my corporation's professor wanted us to understand that New York courts these days do not follow Cardozo very often in finding such a duty, as, for example, between fellow investors in a closely held corporation, that Massachusetts courts, I hasten to inform you, do find such a duty more often, showing New York's determination to be more hospitable to arm's length business. And finally, as an experienced lawyer and Amherst alum recently quipped to me, "And the Delaware courts? Never." I didn't say it. Anyone who doesn't get that can see me later. Finally, when I was asked to play the Goldbergs in the lobby of my law school in 2008, a year after I had played them in the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse for the senior judges, it was another on November 11th, scheduled by the school. Now, Bach himself had been known to be into numerology, and in my program notes, I wrote not only about Cardozo and the fiduciary relationship between Bach and Count Kaiserlinck, who commissioned the work, but also about how the Goldbergs are a structure of 10 groups of 3 pieces each, for a total of 30, showing Bach's devotion to the Trinity. We sat in the Cardozo lobby at 12th Street and 5th Avenue, which happens to be exactly 30 blocks south of the land that was in dispute in Meinhard v. Salmon. And once again, just by coincidence, I had been reading the Versailles Treaty in Professor Lucille Roussin's course on wartime restitution, where on almost every page, one date is cited over and over as the date of control, reference point, status quo ante, ground zero, November 11th, 1918, the armistice. So that concert was taking place precisely on its 90th anniversary. And 90 is, of course, 30 times 3. I leave you with lines I once gave as a gift to a trademark attorney. And trademark law is sort of about puns. So it's about puns and my commitment to a poetic or mystical version of things as against the philosophy of science drummed into us when we were students. It tries to go beyond just granting that ma means mother in many languages. Will idea. Irony of some petty grandeur. Addicted to a Shakespeare, addicted to puns, we despise them. But here's the thing it shows. Though they be only words, not thoughts, as you say, let me show you 7 other names for what it is, and I'll show you why a rose is a rose.
Switch it now.
That's me. It's an honor to be here to talk about these questions of phrases and slogans, etc. My first experience with the power of a slogan was when I was first teaching at NYU, where Larry also teaches, and I put at the bottom of my signature the phrase, "Keep the faith." I was at that time teaching in the Department of Hospitality, Tourism, and Sports Management, and all the students kept saying to me, you know, I don't know if I can do this, I can't understand this. I had the pleasure of teaching a course no one wanted to take, and no one wanted to teach. I was offered Lexus rentals, I was offered firstborn children, gift certificates to restaurants, whatever they needed to just pass the course, because research methods is not something that turns most people on. So my job was to turn them on and convince them they could do high-quality, high-standard work at a research one university. So I had this phrase, "Keep the faith," at the bottom of my signature. At the end of the semester, a colleague came in and said, "I really need to talk to you, Fred. This is a serious matter." And I said, "Okay." And she said, "I'm very insulted, I'm very hurt, and I'm very disturbed." Now, we had worked together, drunk together, played together, etc. She said, "You're proselytizing religion because you have 'keep the faith' in your signature." And I went, talked about it, changed it. We went through the discussion. I told her how many students kept saying it was like a moment of hope, a moment of encouragement that they could really get there if you really believed in yourself. And it makes me think of a slogan that I used when I first started teaching way back in the last century. And I was teaching in a teacher ed program, and I used Eleanor Roosevelt's slogan that no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. Now, many of you may or may not know that Eleanor Roosevelt was shy, uncomfortable in public, scared of people, didn't want to be a speaker, didn't want to be A or B or C, was raised by her grandparents, parents who really abandoned her in many different kinds of ways. But she had the gumption and the temerity and the steel will to get up and do things when Franklin was confined to a wheelchair when it was a New York State issue, And she went out there and listened to people, and she gave speeches in a voice that was not very popular for people to hear, and it was before Julia Child. But she went forward, and she really used this slogan, and it's true. I taught it to my students. You have the power to reject what someone says to you, but you don't have to absorb it. If you get criticism or feedback or negative something coming your way, you can say yes to it and you can say no to it. And it was very helpful for me because it helped me look back at my experience at Amherst. When I came here, I knew I was just an average student. I wasn't very smart. I just sort of played under the radar. I wasn't a good athlete or jock. I was part of Lumley's group that Mayo would be put into whatever track piece there was, right? Yeah. You know, oh, Mayo, today you're running the 2-miler. Oh, today you're running the half mile. Oh, you're doing the 220 today. Wherever there was space in the field, Mayo would be out there running. And I realized I was average or less. That was okay. I realized in my classes I was average or less. That was okay. And then when I got to this slogan, teaching other teachers, I thought, you know, you don't have to absorb all of that. And you can do things and you can go forward. And so it was very invigorating for me, and I think it made a big difference with a lot of teachers. I used it in a lot of T-group work, personal growth work, etc. And the second one I want to talk about is something I learned about in the 80s, which was still in the last century. In May of 1980, I was invited as a person in the helping and healing professions to South Fallsburg, where Swami Muktananda had an open workshop for anyone who wanted to learn about meditation. I went, it was a wonderful day, we meditated, he talked, we had some small group discussion, and slowly but surely I got very involved in meditation. And I've literally meditated since 1980. Not every day, Sam, just I'm average, you're exceptional, well, you could do it every day. But what was wonderful for me is the preaching and the teaching of that practice of Swami Muktananda and later Guru Mai Chidvilasananda was to see God in each other and to practice seeing God in each other in every day, every time, every situation. A tough discipline when you're not in the ashram, when you're in the street and you're working, etc. But the piece that really transformed my career and my work was his slogan that was on the wall in the hall. And the hall was a place that held about 3,000 people for most programs. And the slogan was, only those who lead, those who serve can lead. And it really helped me immensely when I became an administrator in higher education. And at one time I was the dean of the faculty at the Culinary Institute of America. And I was a suit, I knew my place, I walked 6 paces behind the chefs, but I was responsible for 85 full-time faculty members, 65 of which were chefs, and they knew better than me, and they reminded me often that they knew better than me, and that I was responsible for transforming the school and bringing a focus to teaching and learning and to change the participatory, to change a hierarchical management style to a participatory management style. And the only way I got through that was to always think that my job is to serve them, not to scold them, not to tell them, but to serve them. And it really brought a whole different approach to the kinds of things I did. And what happened is I would come out of difficult meetings, situations like that, and I'd walk down the hallway, and all of a sudden I would be chanting, not too loudly, but loudly enough, stuff that I had learned at the ashram and had just become part of me. And I realized I was practicing those kinds of disciplines in that kind of situation. And I learned an enormous amount from doing that, but it kept me going. It kept me reminding that if you're leading someone, you're really serving someone. And this is long before I read about servant leadership or anything like that. But it puts a different approach to how you do things. And nowadays on my kitchen shelf, in the window is my favorite slogan. It says, I didn't choose to be gay, I just got lucky.
Fred, John, could I step in here? Because I spent time in the same ashram in the early 80s as Fred did, and this will be extremely brief, but I feel impelled to add another thing that was printed on the walls, another slogan of Muktananda's, which I just feel I want to give all of you, which is that God dwells within you as you.
We should have begun this whole thing with the opening chant.
Let's not go to
Well, let's go on. Phil.
Thank you. I thought it was a great idea that John proposed this program, and I've been collecting lines, memorable words for all my life, and it's so hard to go back. I started to look through all this on my computer, so many that I'd saved. What do I choose? What do I use? What are the best ones? There's so many. Thelonious Monk, there are no wrong notes. Leibniz, why is there something rather than nothing? Al Capone, you can get much farther with a kind word and a gun than you can with a kind word alone.
Or they like that.
Even better, Sir Thomas Beecham, whoever he was, what a critic, he said, after an elephant crapped on stage during Aida rehearsals.
He was a conductor.
Kennedy's Ask Not What Your Country Can Do For You was very moving to me when he spoke the line, and for many, many years of my life. But I'm no longer so sure that it was the thought of it, the patriotism, the idea of self-sacrifice that inspired me. It's actually, really, when the more you think about it, it's a fairly bland idea. It's what really moved me, I think, was JFK himself. His voice, his charisma, most of all, his intelligence. There was something about the way he deliberated, about his wit, that made you feel that intellect matters, and that for us to have as president someone who counted intellect so high, and that democracy could produce such a leader, made you feel so proud of your country. Other words I considered. Back in grad school, I was struck by this line from Virginia Woolf's Orlando. No passion is stronger in the breast of a man than the desire to make others believe as he believes. Nothing so cuts at the root of his happiness and fills him with rage as the sense that another rates low what he prizes high. Well, people can debate, you know, what moves people, what they want out of life. Is it money, sex, honor? So many things we could list. But Wolf's insight explains more human behavior than just about anything I've ever read, from Plato to Marx to Freud. I was also in grad school when I attended the opening lecture by poet Daniel Hoffman, and he knocked me over by saying, "This is a course to change your sensibility." Wow, you know, it's such a simple thought, but so profound for me. Our everyday lives involve these one-to-one correspondences. That's what we need to operate on a daily basis. But there's another kind of sensibility, not just that clarity, that straightforwardness to get through from moment to moment. But poetry, art, represent this different kind of sensibility in which words and images resonate. They connect different experiences and ideas. They provoke imagination that touch our feelings. It's so basic, so obvious, but until you think about it, you forget how important it is not to have just a single practical sensibility. Another line, when Wynton Marsalis gave a graduating class 19 years ago his definition of soul, it was quoted in the alumni magazine, and I cut it out and have it under a glass on my desk. Soul is when you leave someone feeling better than they felt when you got there. Go through all the definitions of soul by philosophers and theologians. You won't find one like that, but you won't find one any better. My final candidates that we have can put up here. a Gary Larson cartoon. One that I had to frame this years ago, and to me this says it all. You know, for those of you who can't read, in the first caption, three cows are standing on their hind legs in a sloping field near a road, and a fourth cow is standing, also apparently on hind legs, just over the slope, so we can only see its upper body. His head is turned toward the other cows, and he's saying, "Car!" Second panel, the cows are on all fours, and the car carrying the usual Gary Larson clueless humans comes over the slope. The woman in the passenger seat looks over at the cows. Third panel, the car is gone, and the cows are standing on their hind legs again. Well, to me, it just says, you know, how do you know anything? How can you be sure, right? Don't take anything for granted. Don't assume things. We assume too much. Look behind the curtain. And finally, I want to close with this one. The 1933 movie, Dinner at Eight. Jean Harlow, the blonde bombshell, the Marilyn Monroe of her day, she plays a gold digger, a trophy wife. She mentions to the much older, heavier Maria Dressler, "I was reading a book the other day." "Reading a book?" Dressler replies. "Yes," says Harlow. "It's all about civilization or something. A nutty kind of a book. You know, the guy says that machinery is going to take the place of every profession." Dressler, looking her over, head to toe, says, "Oh, my dear, that is something you need never worry about." Well, reading books is my favorite pastime. Harlow's casual comment that she was reading one the other day, and Dressler's terse reply, a bit astonished, wonderfully expresses the place of reading in the lives of most people. And certainly not reading books about civilization, books like those we read in History 1-2 and so many of our Amherst courses. Harlow's way of putting it, civilization or something, is about as lucid an expose of our civilization as any of the dozens of books that we read and said very much the same thing. These books, though, Amherst introduced us to, are to most people, like Harlow, nutty. Let's be honest. For me, that line trumps even the very funny punchline, but that, of course, is also wonderful. The idea that machinery may take the place of every profession, but not, Dressler concludes, the profession of sex. Today, we might wonder whether virtual reality might replace even that profession as well. Movies since 1933 show sex as far more complicated than they did in 1933, perhaps. But even if machines could replace sex or some part of sex, even Harlow's character and her movie hint that our humanity will not be so easily destroyed.
At the reunion 5 years ago, Andrew Hacker, class of 51, pointed to Kant's categorical imperative as something every student encountered as part of a good liberal arts education. I didn't encounter it at Amherst. It wasn't part of the philosophy course that I took, but I did discover a simplified version of it in a book about Amherst, Alison Lurie's first novel, Love and Friendship, a trenchant, ironic view of the college in our era, and especially everyone's favorite course, English 1-2. That version read, "Behave as though your every act could become the basis for a social law." That hits home to me. If we are on Earth to improve the world, and I think that's the reason we're here, we do it by setting an example in our own lives. We do it by looking toward the general good, not our own self-interest, something that is admittedly easier to do as you get older and leave behind the messiness of youth. I won't go into details about what I've done. That would sound terribly conceited on the one hand and woefully inadequate on the other. I will note that there were many people all around who never noticed the wonderful example I'm setting and who failed to follow my excellent lead. Not to mention, of course, the many, many times that I myself fall short. I will say there are times, such as when I'm picking up stray poop at the dog park, that I wonder if this is what Kant had in mind. Nevertheless, I pick up the poop. The second quote is one that I did encounter at Amherst in Professor Marx's American Literature course. It's from Henry James's Ambassadors, The Ambassadors. Lambert Strether, a middle-aged New Englander, has come to Paris, and the city causes him to take a hard look at the life that he's led. This is the advice Strether gives to someone who has his life ahead of him. Live all you can. It's a mistake not to. It doesn't matter so much what you do in your life, so in what you do in particular, as long as you have had your life. If you don't have that, what have you had? Junior year in college is a particularly propitious and a particularly dangerous time to come across this quote. Up till then, your life has been charted. Soon you will have to chart your own. Strether's advice is both very definite, live all you can, and very indefinite. It doesn't matter so much what you do in particular, but it has to matter, doesn't it? The disjunction in this quote etched itself inside my brain, and I've been pondering it ever since. I've answered Strether's challenge by saying yes instead of no, by taking risks, by pushing aside doubts, and by trying out temptations. That's another great quote from Oscar Wilde. The only way to get rid of a temptation is to yield to it. I have learned that the more risks you take, the more adventures you set out on, the fewer regrets you end up with. Now, I have limits. For example, in senior year, my roommate Jeff Hoffman decided that mountain climbing was too tame for him, and he decided to take up skydiving. Skydiving didn't interest me, but if I'd been torn, shouldn't I, I would have taken Strether's advice and jumped. I'd like to make one more point. I think we all go through lives with quotations from one source or another in our heads. The advantage of a liberal arts education is that it gives you access to the best, the highest quality thoughts. That, to me, is sufficient justification for a liberal arts education. Thank you. Now it's your turn. Does anyone have anything to say? Yes, Larry.
Is there a microphone?
Right here.
I'm delighted by this panel, and I have to say it's the sort of thing that could never occur at my current university, NYU, because the faculty and many of the students are so narrowly focused on particular specialties that they would never think about life in the broad way that you have. They simply aren't very good at asking questions and coming up with interesting answers. They're focused primarily on learning a set of analytic techniques and answering questions that have already been defined for them by various academic specialties. So I guess you could say that wisdom is leaking out of the academic life.
Anyone, Elliot? Come down and get a microphone.
Here you go, Elliot. Elliot, here you go. Hi, I'm Elliot. So I lived in Asia for my 28th year, and I lived in these different ashrams where I even heard a lot about Muktananda. And the law that was drilled into you regularly was the law of karma, which was not stated in a way similar to the West. It was 100% based on intention. In other words, the same act could, with a different intention, have a totally different karma. So if the intention was positive, we'd have a positive outcome. Negative intention, negative outcome, and most hopeful was no intention, and then you would just be. So anyway, so this phrase came to me during this time, and I just loved it as expressing this law of karma, but I don't say it with the word karma for Western people. I usually put in the word fairness or justice. So this is the sentence. I have to say something else. Okay, everything in Asia is wheels. Like samsara is a wheel. This is the wheel of birth and death. Wheels are what this whole existence is seen. It's not seen like you're going anywhere. It's just a wheel, a revolution. So this is the way the sentence go. No, I just have to get. I want to get quiet to have a full meeting.
At the wheels?
No, at the wheels.
Well, that's a quotation too.
I'm going to give you the quote. Okay.
It's like that piece by John Cage. Four minutes and 33 seconds. That was the title.
Okay, here's the quote: "The wheels of karma," or you could say justice or fairness, "grind excruciatingly slow." But you have to say excruciatingly like it's a crucifixion. This is excruciatingly slow, but exceedingly fine. So the wheels of, let's say, karma grind excruciatingly slow, but exceedingly fine. So that's, in a sense, been my philosophy since India. So many people in the West tell me, like sentences like, "nice guys end up last." Well, I don't believe that.
Elliot, isn't there a quote in the Bible that's very similar?
You hear the same thing in a lot of fields.
Okay.
Jeff is going to say
that. Sorry. Who? Anyone else?
Jeff.
Oh, yes.
Jeff Hoffman. Make it long.
Well, it's not about a giant step for mankind, anyway. But but it does have some relation to space, and it's from someone who was always one of my heroes. And it does relate to our freshman year, which, if you remember, we went through the Newtonian synthesis, and Newton's physics came in large part from a lot of the work that Galileo did with his mechanics. And Galileo has always been one of my heroes. And so the quotation actually is what he is reported to have muttered after having been forced by the Inquisition to recant the heliocentric theory, which was "a può si muove," and yet it does move. Yeah. And I think it has a sense both in terms of science, because that era was the beginning of our modern scientific approach to the world, that it doesn't matter if it's written or if somebody in authority says it, you can use your own experience to achieve a vision of what truth is. And just because someone tells you that it's not true, and of course, on the other hand, it has very important social implications, because, you know, sometimes we talk about talking truth to power, but it also is a reminder that sometimes power wins, because Galileo was, after that, put under house arrest for the rest of his life, and that was also part of my admiration for what he was willing to basically endure in following the truth. And so, yes, it does move.
Michael Katz.
Maybe for him. He's coming down.
He's coming.
Okay, good.
So 5 years ago, I was co-chair with David Browder of the 45th reunion, and we had a session on teachers at Amherst and teachers you had in your life that made a difference, that changed the way you experience things. And one of the things that teachers do, I had the good fortune of teaching teachers for almost 40 years in the university. One of the things that teachers do is not just initiate you into some mastery of the subject or get you excited about learning, but certain teachers also inspire you to think larger thoughts and bigger thoughts. And one of my favorite lines comes from one of my favorite writers, V.S. Naipaul. V.S. Naipaul wrote a book called The Bend in the River, and it's about an Indian village that's surrounded by the bush in Africa. And one of the characters says to the other, "We create ourselves according to the ideas we have of our possibilities. We create ourselves according to the ideas we have of our possibilities." And given what Larry said earlier about how we create life plans and goals and everything, I think that's very appropriate to the way the wonderful panel has talked about what's inspired them. Thanks.
When I was teaching high school chemistry, I came across the following story about the man who discovered the periodic table, Mendeleev. Some of you may know this story. So Mendeleev was quite a brilliant fellow, and he was also an art collector. Of course, he did get into the Art Society of Russia, but he never made it into the Chemistry Society because of the following thing. When he was in his middle age, he was attracted by a very young girl. I think she might have been 13 or 14 or 15 or whatever. And he left his wife and he followed this young woman all across Europe until she agreed to become his companion. And this was very shocking in Russia. It was considered bigamy. So someone went to the Tsar and said, "Mr. Tsar, this is terrible. Mendeleev has two wives." And the Tsar looked at him. It's about privilege, you see. Privilege. Let's remember, there's a book called The Dark Side of Camelot about certain escapades that happened in the White House under JFK, which maybe some of you might want to read. But anyhow, so the Tsar looked at him and he says, "Yes, Mendeleev has two wives, but I have only one Mendeleev. Mendeleev can have two wives, but you can't."
I was searching my mind for something worth saying, quote, and then I got one. The power of suggestion of just leading our thinking. This is for over 20 years I was a practicing Quaker, and somewhere along the way, there was a story told about what was going on in Philadelphia at the time of the Salem witch trials around Boston. And there was a woman who was accused of being a witch, and she was brought in front of the board that ran the city of Philadelphia and dispensed justice. William Penn was the leader and the supreme judge of that. And they brought forward this old woman, and William Penn asked her if she could fly on a broomstick through the sky, and she said, "Why, yes, she could." And he then said, "What a wonderful thing to be able to do." Not guilty.
I'm Doug Dunlap, by the way. I don't know if I'm recognizable, but Hearing Jeff speak, I'm reminded that F equals MA, allowing for friction, has been very important to me in a number of social change, community organizing situations. Remember, force equals mass times acceleration, allow for friction, and so deal with the friction. I seem to have the quote of the day. I'm remembering particularly, though, as we gather now, I had the great privilege of spending some time with John Sharefkin about 10 days before he left us. And we had been planning a fly fishing trip based upon an incidental conversation in the Valentine line. The line was going slowly. I heard somebody behind me say something about fly fishing. I turned around, started talking with him, and it wound up with us making plans to do that in Maine. It never happened quite the way it was supposed to, but it did happen when I paid a visit at Tufts New England Medical Center, went into his room with a full complement of fly fishing gear, including a fly rod. I don't think they let me in these days. And one of the items that I brought to him was a postcard from Montana. And on the postcard was two people who were fishing. And one of them is in a boat and is shaking his fist at the other person who is there with waders on, standing in the river, also fishing, also shaking his fist back at him. And the caption on the card was, "Roe versus Wade." John gets the last word on this. The second part of the caption said the great Montana fly fishing controversy. And John just laughed and laughed. It was a great belly laugh. It was beautiful. It was beautiful to see. And we were both with tears of laughter. And he said, "We all need to learn when to not take ourselves so seriously, and that which we feel so passionate about, we need to be able to laugh about." So that's for John. Thank you.
Is there anyone else? Any other hands raised? Yes.
Oh, they're going. Lead all night. That's great. Good for you, John.
I'm on my toes because I can't see all these people. Yeah.
Okay. Dwight Rogers. I was always a big walker when I was here at Amherst, and I don't know if I ever met any of you out walking out in what was called then the Game Preserve. Maybe it still is the Game Preserve. And it took a long time for me to have the short, pithy saying that kind of sustained me in this. But it was on a poster by a walking trail. It was ascribed to, I think, it's British author F.W. Maitland. And it said, "Solvitur ambulando," which translates to, "It is solved by walking." So I was out walking. I'm a little damp here. But, you know, we used to have a Boston and Maine rail line. Just off campus here, which is not the Central Vermont, which is still active. And it's now a trail, and there are people out there biking and walking. And I walked today down to milepost 9.5 and back. And not that it solved anything. I have all these piles of paper at home. Many of you have that too, and I'm sorting through them. And this thing pops out. It's a quotation from Wallace Stevens, and it was another one that helped me put in focus. It says, perhaps the truth is a walk around the lake. So hope to see you out on the trails. Thank you.
Oh, yes.
Hello. I'm John Sessions. We've heard stories of people finding themselves in situations where they have to make big decisions, and that can always be hard. Is that working better? Oh, good. See, there's one decision. And actually, it could be quite appropriate. At any rate, my father, the great sage that he was, had a very good way of dealing with the sort of small decisions we make every day in our lives, and that we shouldn't be always so, you know, uptight about making them, because in his words, no matter what you do, it's wrong. ah!
I'd like to contradict that. My father was an Amherst graduate, and when I was a sophomore, I was working the bartending for his reunion. My father had a different way of saying it. My father said something. He used to say, tell me your decision because it's probably right, but don't tell me your reasons because they're probably wrong.
John, somebody over here?
I'm one missing, one extra step. Thanks. I'm Irene Starr. My husband Norton Starr taught here for 43 years, but he started in the fall of 66, so I think you did not overlap. Oh, one of my favorite expressions was from a history teacher in high school. Anticipation is greater than realization. And my other, one of my other favorites is from Gandhi. Live as if you were to die tomorrow. Learn as if you were to live forever.
We've just adopted women in our class. Don't tell us.
I love this class. Don't.
Wonderful.
Yesterday, wasn't that 66?
Yeah.
Yes. And then, are you doing the psychic workshop too?
Yeah. No.
66 is? So, well, I love your class. Okay. the quote is from Tale of Two Cities, and I think it's really appropriate here at Reunion because it has
Mike.
To
Mike.
Oh, Tale of Two Cities. Okay. And it says, a wonderful fact to reflect upon, that every human creature is constituted to be the profound secret and mystery to every other. And I think as we, I'm going to cry. I cry always. But I'm just, I'm so honored to be part of this group. And every single, I think even your best friends, when you come to a thing like this, you realize they are a mystery. There's so much to them. They're so multifaceted, and I just am absolutely thrilled to be part of this community.